Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Alejandro Ponce de Leon from the University of California, Davis. We're joined today by Christina Lyons, Assistant Professor of Anthropology and affiliated with the Program in Environmental Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Today, we will be talking about her book, Vital Decomposition, Soil Practitioners and Life Politics, published by Duke University Press in 2020. In Vital Decomposition, Christina offers an ethnography of human-soil relations by following the practical engagements of soil scientists and peasants across labs, forests, and farms. The book attends to the struggles and collaborations between multiple actors over the meaning of peace, productivity, rural development, and sustainability in contemporary Colombia. Welcome, Christina, to New Books in Environmental Studies.
Thanks so much, Alejandro. I'm really pleased to be here today talking to you about this. Thanks for the invitation.
Would you want to start by telling us a little bit more about yourself? I know you received a PhD from anthropology at UC Davis, but I would like to learn a little bit more about how you got involved or interested in this field of study. How do you ended up conducting fieldwork in Colombia?
Sure. So I have a background in creative writing and Spanish or more precisely Latin American literature. And when I started a joint MA program in journalism and Latin American studies at UT Austin, I was kind of directed more towards anthropology. It was recommended to me as a way to do sustained rather than kind of parachute kinds of investigative research and supposedly less censorship over an editing intervention in the kind of research that I wanted to be doing. And so before I started fieldwork in Colombia, I had worked in human rights, labor rights, and also on displacement by large infrastructural projects in other parts of Central and South America, and with a particular focus on U.S. interventions, foreign policy, corporate, military, and otherwise. And I came to the project in Southern Colombia that informs this book after working as a consultant at INRED in Quito, Ecuador, Colombia. It's a human rights organization in Ecuador. And I was an independent consultant there looking at what happens to Colombian refugees who are denied status as refugees. And this is where I really learned about the impacts of the U.S.-Colombia war on drugs and the denial of refugee status to people who had been displaced due to the aerial fumigation of glyphosate, many of which of these folks are from Putumayo. And that's how I came about this work and got affiliated with human rights and policy watch groups in Colombia, Asociación Minga, and also Witness for Peace. And that's how I came about the work that informed this book in the last 17 years kind of my life.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the southern region of Colombia in which your book is situated? Maybe starting with its history or geography, what makes this place different from other parts of Colombia?
Yeah, so the Andean Amazonian foothills and plains of Colombia or the western Amazon where the book is really situated is a tri-frontier region of the country, bordering Peru and Ecuador. And the Colombian Amazon, like the larger Amazon basin, is made up of heterogeneous worlds. But there is a shared and distinct history that unfolded between the eastern and western Amazon of the country, beginning with the Spanish colonization in the 15th century and Jesuit and Franciscan missionization that influenced, that entered into the region. And the western Amazon has been a site of extraction of kind of boom and bust economies, starting back from the rubber boom, quina, skins, timber, especially with the famous and destructive Casa Arana in the early 1900s, that reconfigured indigenous territories and life worlds in the Amazon, in the western part of the Amazon. And this part of this region has been a receptor of waves of colonization since the 1930s, starting with the Colombian-Peru War, and especially in the 1950s with displaced families and individuals from the bipartisan violence in the interior of the country. And then in the 1960s with state-directed colonization projects and the oil boom that began in especially in the Putumayo, Department of Putumayo. And then later in the 1980s or in the 1980s with the coca cultivation, what the state calls illicit coca crops, that really intensified and propelled another round of migration to the region. And Putumayo, along with Caquetá and Guaviare, the other two departments you can think of as the Western Amazon of Colombia, have been the epicenter of the U.S.-Colombian war on drugs, and especially the aerofumigation policy and alternative, quote-unquote, alternative development interventions. It's also a territory that has been in the epicenter of the internal armed conflict in the country, really a hegemonic presence, territorial presence of the FARC after they disputed with other insurgent groups, also paramilitary repression and backlash that came upon the presence of the FARC, pushing them into the rural corridors and really taking over many of the small towns and kind of more urban areas at different points. And I think Putumayo in this region, the Andean foothills and plains, is a really very inter-ethnic world with campesinos, indigenous people, also Afro-Colombian communities that have been pushed into this region, whether they're originary communities or voluntary or involuntary displaced or migrant communities. And so there's an enormous amount of biocultural diversity that really defines this area that, I mean, a lot of the discourse focuses around state abandonment and there's been a particular kind of state presence, unfortunately, one that's focused really more on militarization and police presence and kind of repressive policies from the sky, like the aerofumigation, and not so much social services and other forms of state presence. But I also really think that it's important to put emphasis on the biocultural diversity of the region just as much as we can think through these other kind of discourses of state absence and violence.
I think that something that it's important for us as we think about El Putumayo is Plan Colombia. Would you expand a little bit more of what Plan Colombia entails for the region?
Yeah, so Plan Colombia is the name of the another name for the U.S. War on Drugs, the foreign policy package that really began in 2000. And there were different stages of Plan Colombia that went up really into 2012 or 2014 even. But the focus of the kind of aid that came from the United States through this foreign policy was 80% really through these periods, military and police, strengthening military and police force and rule of law. And also with a huge focus on counter-narcotics strategies, whether it be manual eradication, forced eradication of illicit crops, or the aerofumigation with glyphosate, which is really the core component, one of the essential components of the war on drugs, which has been the use of Monsanto's glyphosate in a very concentrated formulation formula. And sprayed, indiscriminately, really, over entire ecologies where illicit crops are supposedly located, and has been really ineffective and environmentally destructive, and also destructive to the public health of communities in these coca growing regions, because of the fact that the aerofumigation, unsurprisingly, right, is hitting pastures and watersheds and local schools and subsistence crops. And affecting people's health and not really at all ever eradicating the supposed illicit crops, right? They end up moving around Colombia as the fumigation kind of focuses in one area, the coca moves to another. And Putumayo in Caquetá and Guaviare were really the epicenters of this kind of intervention. And the millions of dollars that came through the alternative development, that was another, it was kind of the a different side of the same coin of the eradication and then the alternative development supposedly substituting those crops. And these projects mainly failed. And that's really one of the focuses of the book is that because they were export-oriented, so it was an export-oriented licit crop meant to replace an export-oriented illicit crop, and really no other imagining of an alternative agroecological world that could exist in these regions of the Amazon, fortunately.
So now I want to talk about the book. So whenever we hear the word ethnography, we usually think about people or people in places. The book is, however, an ethnography of soil and soil practices. What do you mean by that?
So I talk about following practices that make practitioners rather than already existing categories such as soil scientist or soil or rural human communities. Right. So I'm interested in the book and how soils become such, right? And in the making of soil also makes or unmakes their specialist or the state soil scientist and the heterogeneous range of scientists that I do follow through my field work. So the book is thinking about how objects and subjects are made through relations, right, and that are not already existing categories. And I'm also interested in the book in decolonizing practices that unravel liberal ideas of the human, that undo the nature-culture binaries that oblige the human to tame or domesticate the selva, the Amazon. So rather than the book, following. The thinking through the human, I'm really thinking about the process of becoming some other kind of human, an Amazonian human, or what I talk about in the book as selvacinos rather than campesinos. So Amazonian human, one that inhabits, eats, shits, exchanges differently. So the ethnography also moves between laboratories and greenhouses and government offices and monocrop fields in Bogota and other urban centers of the country in the interior, and selva realities, agrarian protests, huertas and huertos, gardens and social movements in Putumayo and also in Sucumbíos, Ecuador, in a small area of Nariño. So I move between these practitioners that don't directly dialogue or meet with each other, but that are intimately connected as matters of concern for one another, as objects of intervention for each other, and even unlikely allies or potential allies. And so that's kind of the way that I think through the relations rather than the already existing, like, quote-unquote, community or object or subject.
So studies of regions like Putumayo tend to focus on the violence and destruction that comes with armed violence, right? Your book, while dealing with these themes, it tries to slow down our thinking about death and destruction and tries to invite us to see these processes through different lenses. As you suggest in the introduction of the book, the networks of campesinos and indigenous communities that you met in and around Putumayo quickly taught you that violence was not the only story to be told. They obliged you to turn your ethnographic attention away from what was raining down on them from crop dusters to kinds of propositional life-making processes being actualized in the midst of chemically degraded ecologies. Could you please tell us a little bit more about this turn in your work and practice and about how these life processes become? I honestly find it fascinating and really new how your book tries to tie decay and death to the process of life through ethnography.
So this was one of the key shifts in the project and in my thinking. And what I saw, especially through my kind of work with human rights organizations and these policy watch groups, was that they were doing an extraordinary job, an important work, denouncing the violence that was occurring in the region. But that the project that I had originally thought I was going to be engaged in, which was with a focus on the aerial fumigation policy and toxicity and science and non-scientific collaborations and advocacy work, really kind of trapped me in a little bit in a position of denouncing and critiquing the policy and denouncing the policy. And at the time, there was a real move in Colombia, even from human rights organizations and I would say, like, you know, activist scientists away from critiquing this policy because it was a dead end. It was really looking grim about the possibility of transforming the aerial fumigation policy and the war on drugs in the repressive nature of it and transforming that. And when I was doing my preliminary field work, upon visiting the hojarasca, the first Amazonian farm school that I discuss in the opening of the book, and meeting Heraldo and Nelson and Elva and many other families in agrarian and social movements, that I was pushed to think about more than denouncing the problem or diagnosing the problem, but about the propositions of the proposals that were not given as much attention in the region, that were the real struggles of people in their everyday, but also in mobilized ways and organized ways to transform this the reality and transform their relations with the territory, outside of the established models that were either, you know, the dominant agricultural or the narco-trafficking and illicit economy options. And so I take seriously this need to be propositional in the book in terms of my fieldwork with the not only with the rural communities, but with the network of scientists and that I follow and that I work with. And I think that this really emerged from taking inspiration from both the hojarasca, what I talk about in the book, from the hojarasca itself, right? The materiality, the temporality, the movement, the intensity, the velocity of hojarasca. And my readings of Isabel Stengers during my training in cultural anthropology. And the hojarasca was making the farmers engage in a slowing down process, a slowing down of reasoning, really, and reclaiming practices that, and also being inventive, right? So it wasn't just a return to an idealized past, but about reclaiming practices and trying to make them proliferate, reclaiming and relaying what I talk about in the book, I'm Thinking with Stengers. And so that shift in the project pushed me towards La Hojarasca and the hojarasca and what becomes soil and what cannot be soil, right? What is not scientifically categorized or classified as soil, because it poses challenges to that classification system and the making of an object that can be separated from its relational contingency, its interdependency. And that's what became the focus of the book. And that this hojarasca that was escaping classification as soil and that could not be turned into the prime agricultural soils of industrial agriculture was really the inspiration to think about how life and death are not in this biopolitical move to stave off death or to oppose them, but also to understand that sedimentation happens also through destruction, that decay also produces germination, that there is no guarantee, there is no clinging to life in a context of social and armed conflict as it connects with the war on drugs, but that there was a different move on the part of the communities and the families or the alternative agricultural networks that I had the opportunity to work with for so many years, and that was the shift in the project and it was following those movements that were not binary. They were not binary movements, and really trying to think about bettering conflict. How do you bettering conflict and to get outside of these kind of tolerance on the one hand or eradication models on the other, or zero tolerance policies really that are the state model. And getting outside of those kind of binaries in, as an ethical political project, but also as the materiality of hojarasca itself and what kind of thinking that was producing, what kind of slowing down that was producing. And also for the scientists that I started to work with, right, that the hojarasca posed different enigmas for them that became problems, while for the rural families that I was working with in the Amazon, it wasn't a problem to be solved, but rather was an opportunity to unlearn and relearn, which has really became the focus of the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So we've been thinking about La Hojarasca and its materiality. However, there's a second hojarasca that you've already mentioned, the school. And in the school in itself is central to the story that you're presenting here. Could you tell us a little bit more about the work that La Hojarasca is doing? What kind of practices are we talking about?
Yeah, so La Hojarasca was an Amazonian farm school that at the time, in 2007, when I first visited it, was being supported by CINEP, which is a center in Bogota that supports like popular education and research and other topics. And CINEP was financing on this school, which was really a space for, at the time, like around 100 campesino and indigenous folks to get trained in Amazonian agriculture, to get a diploma in Amazonian agriculture in this farm school setting. And it was really, as I talk about in the book, in a kind of devastated landscape that had been demoralized and silenced by the war on drugs and the repressive nature of the aerial spraying and the effects that had on subsistence crops and the forestry and just agriculture in general. This space was a really inspiring, literally pulsating space of life-making practices that became the central place where I first met Heraldo, who became one of my central interlocutors and co-thinkers and the protagonist of the manuscript. And the farm school, as I talk about in the book, didn't survive past a few years, really, when the CINEP funding ended. The farm school was handed back to a local campesino organization. And that isn't unlike many of the other kind of externally funded projects in Putumayo, but what was more important was the kind of energies that farm school was gathering and the potentiality to multiply these practices. And I don't like to call them, I don't call them agroecological practices, because that was something important to my interlocutors, to the campesino and alternative agricultural practitioners in the book, was to distinguish themselves from concepts like permaculture, organic agriculture, agroecology, because these kind of concepts are not necessarily rooted in Amazonian ancestral and traditional and popular practices, but also don't necessarily distance them from industrial agriculture, because you can have industrial organic agriculture with inputs, chemical and commercial inputs, not chemical, excuse me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start over about that part. having organic agriculture can be based on commercial inputs just as much as you know, commercial industrial agriculture. So replacing the commercial inputs is not really the goal, right? It's about returning to recovering and also innovating practices to learn how to farm alo amazónico, according to selva logics and selva ethics, really, and selva temporalities, and learning rather than to colonize the selva, and to recolonize the farm with the selva. And that's really the kind of practices that were being taught at La Hojarasca Farm School that Heraldo was involved in, and then was multiplying outside of that particular farm school setting through his kind of informal agricultural technical assistance and advocacy work with other rural communities in the area.
The book in itself is a beautiful ethnography, but it also offers a wide range of concepts. which you're co-thinking with your interlocutors. Amongst them, we find Heraldo Vallejo, who you just mentioned, and it's who is also known in the region as El Hombre Amazónico, the Amazonian man. I admire how your work stays with the concepts that Heraldo is proposing and that emerge from his own practical engagements with different life worlds in the region. But more importantly, I find that the way you use these concepts to raise important ethical and political questions is quite innovative. The book in itself suggests that it emerged from taking serious decolonizing enactments of asymmetry as a conceptual and political, or better yet, life proposal that displaces the primacy of knowing in favor of ongoing processes of unlearning and relearning. So what anthropologists call emic perspectives are here raised as the poetics that the field in itself is offering. Could you tell me more about your relation with Heraldo as a co-thinker? What decolonizing entailed for your project?
So Heraldo, Nelson and Elva and many other families and social movement leaders are organic philosophers for me, or organic intellectuals. And I tried to build what Kim Tallbear calls a shared conceptual ground with them without erasing our differential positions and privileges. So to really think about the kinds of research questions in that shared conceptual ground. And not to explain their proposals or their concepts that they taught me through relational theories of new materialism or feminist science studies or political ontologies and their analytics, which I've been trained in my graduate school training, but to put these ideas in conversation with their ideas and push back on these relational theories. Using the kinds of relational practices and thinking of my interlocutors. So I'm always thinking about the publics in Colombia with whom I'm engaging. And the mode of doing research and the conceptual creativity of the farmers I worked with, the campesinos, really was an invitation against extractivism in all its forms. And as they're also rejecting, right, extractivism and all its kinds of manifestations. So really that became, in my conversations with Heraldo, we would, in which I would, be presenting before I presented papers or any chapters showing the work to him. And we would have joking conversations about the poetics of shit, for instance, or the poetic writing about decay and decomposition. And how beautiful I made that sound right in the book. and it wasn't a problem, right? It was actually, there was an embracing of that kind of affective sensorial aspects, right? Because the proposal of making life happier, right, on the part of these farmers, which is a way to say like making life happier and not making it better, quote unquote, better, but to help people remain rather than be displaced and dispossessed, is wrapped up in questions of happiness, of emotion, of sentiment, caring, hope, love, and that potentiality. And multiplying that through the resonating farms that I talk about, literally through the way that farms, as they come back to life and come to life in a different way, resonate and create a vital energy that then proliferates from farm to farm, which is not the same as convincing your neighbor or imposing a model on the other, right? And so that kind of vital spaces, the creation of those vital spaces, was an invitation to think affectively and aesthetically about life, making life happier, and what are the aesthetics of that? And so that was part of our conversations. And because these farmers are against privatization and the kinds of individualization that's based on and produces and reproduces, they were really happy to invite me to also engage in my creative conceptualizations with the concepts that we were thinking together or that they were teaching me. And so as long as I stayed true to their arguments when I was talking about their arguments, right, I had the creative license, right, to engage in my own conceptual work. And this is really, it's very similar to their thoughts about, for instance, like, the philosophy about community seed banks. And the idea of a community seed bank isn't to store the seed, isn't to keep it for myself or my family, but it's to proliferate, to share, to to sow, to plant, right? And for more people to take up these seeds and plant them and experiment with them and their medicinal and nutritional uses in their own way on their farms, in their gardens, in their forests. And so that was a similar kind of logic about the way concepts were able to travel and one could make them their own with, through their own creative work. And that was part of the proliferation and the kind of anti-privatization move or intellectual property move that the farmers also extended to me in my ethnographic work. And I think that another, you know, part of the project was taking serious the need to write and publish in both languages, in both Spanish and English, and to engage in popular education projects just as much as academic publications and producing other kinds of non-academic materials for and with the community, and about inhabiting academia in an engaged way as a public engagement, kind of thinking about public engaged scholarship. And I think that this work with the, you know, my 3 years that I did the intense field work with these families really, really taught me about ways of doing public engaged scholarship. So I'm really grateful for that opportunity. And I think that's a way that is reflected not only in the book, I hope, but beyond in the ways that I continue to work in and outside of academia.
Contemporary Colombia is a country that may be characterized by its rapid and maybe at times radical transformations. The book was written when the national government was undergoing peace negotiations with some of the main armed actors in its historical armed conflict. What has changed in Colombia since you wrote the book? And what has happened to these landscapes that you have been writing about since then?
So the post-peace accord scenario in Colombia, and I say that, you know, very deliberately to call it a post-peace accord and not a post-conflict setting, there have been some very concrete changes in the regions that were the epicenters of the internal conflict, such as Putumayo. You know, their suspension of the aerial fumigation in 2015 was very important. In its impacts, although there has been manual application of glyphosate and the counter-narcotics police have permitted that. And there's a whole debate happening right now about the reactivation of aerial fumigation, whether it's with glyphosate or some other chemical substance. But the suspension of the aerial fumigation was important. The signing of the peace accords, the demobilization officially of the FARC really allowed for more public life, more movement, definitely less military pretense on the roads, on the highways. And there was a real opening. There was a real sense of hope that the agreements would be implemented and that places like Putumayo for the first time would have voz y voto, right? Voice and protagonism in reshaping their region through the pellets, through the development plans of territorial focus and the alternative crop substitution programs, right? The democratization supposedly of the anti-drug policy and the inter-agrarian reform and all the different promises made in the peace accords. And there was definitely a real sense of hope and possibility and much more participation in scenarios that never existed before. But unfortunately, that window, when there was a sense of shift and of change, has slowly closed again. And the perpetuation of conflict, the persistence of killing of social leaders and of you know, former demobilized combatants, and especially connected to you know, environmental activists or guardians of territories and has been, you know, has continued, has perpetuated in places like Putumayo, as well as the intensification of extractivism, of concessions being granted to oil and mining, industrial mining operations, and that peace created this opening, right, for reconfigurations of armed actors and dissident groups and mafia narco-trafficking networks in places and territories where the FARC demobilized and departed from these territories officially and left them open to new vulnerabilities and different kinds of, you know, environmental degradation intensifying, deforestation intensifying, illegal mining intensifying. And unfortunately, that's been the case in Putumayo and in the surrounding region. At the same time that, you know, the country is participating in a transitional justice process, there are truth commissions, there are reparations and criminal prosecution happening. There's also been a biocentric legal turn in the country that's interfacing with this transitional justice of proliferation of rights of nature cases. And there, in 2018, there was a legal sentence 4360 in Colombia that recognized the Amazon as a subject of rights and of you know, legal personhood in the sense of requiring special protection, being granted those kinds of protection. And so all of this is happening, right? So we can see that there are certain shifts, there are certain continuities, there are certain, unfortunately, intensifications of violence and of conflict and perpetuation. But there are also different actors now entering into the region. And with this sentence of the Amazon, that's also created a different, I don't know if I would say like a different dynamic, but a different, on the one hand, in discursively speaking, appreciation of the Amazon, right, in its entirety, not just the eastern side, but also the western side that was the really epicenter of the war on drugs and the internal armed conflict. And I think that there's potentiality there. There's also that legal sentence was done without a lot of participation from regional actors or local inhabitants. So that also replicates kind of the Andean-centric way that the country has related to its regions and to the Amazon, unfortunately. But, you know, so the folks that are the protagonists in my book continue doing their everyday work. They continue trying to organize and proliferate these practices, and there has been, you know, there have been new cohesions and strengthening of the alternative agricultural networks in the area. At the same time that communities are confronted by uncertainty and unfortunately continued threats and the extractivism, I think that's really one of the core elements, that there cannot be, peace without social justice. And social justice is not only for the social being in terms of the human community, but thinking about the array of actors that are casualties of war and the impacts of the war on the territory and the socio-ecological damages or harms in the territory as a victim. And I think this is definitely the case in Putumayo, and that is really the work of building territorial constructions of peace that communities are continuing to do without the guarantees, as I talk about in my book, without really institutional support. But unfortunately, there's a huge disillusionment about the implementation of the peace accords and the real lack of the state's commitment to implementing these accords. And I think that there's a lot of uncertainty about what will happen with the cocoa growers in the region once the PENICE program, the subsidy program ends, and really what kind of real alternatives will have been produced for alternative livelihoods. And I think, unfortunately, that model, the PENICE, replicated the earlier war on drugs alternative development models in ways that are not going to be successful. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty at the same time that people continue carrying on, and not just carrying on, but flourishing, as I talk about in the book, really in every act, trying to make a different future, right? The potentiality that exists in every actuality, and that continues in Putumayo and in all of Colombia.
Cristina, after Vital Decomposition, what will your next research project be?
So upon finishing this manuscript, you know, for the past couple of years, I've been working on two different kind of sets of projects in Colombia. One is a participatory action research project to support a community-based recovery of a watershed. So territorial ordinance and conservation and recovery of a watershed, but a community-based process to do that in the Amandara River watershed in Puerto Guzmán, Putumayo, the second largest municipality in Putumayo. And that's been a project of a couple of years working with La Fundación Itarca, in a local NGO, a local foundation in Puerto Guzmán, reconstructing the environmental, or what I say, the socio-ecological memory of war in this particular watershed. So doing and really doing a project about community-based modes of reconciliation and reconciliation processes that are only trying to repair the fractured relationships between human communities and that are inter-ethnic in this particular watershed, but how do we reconcile with territories that have also been casualties of multi-layers of violence? So that's been one project that I've been working on in the last couple of years. And the second project focuses more on collaborations with legal spheres in Colombia. So with judges, prosecuting attorneys, with the attorney general's office, and with lawyers, sets of lawyers on the one hand, training prosecuting attorneys in that are agrarian, environmental, and land restitution attorneys on how to think through historical and socio-environmental conflicts in the territories that they're making decisions over and legal concepts and legal rulings over. And on the other hand, I was luckily granted a Fulbright to start working, collaborating with the HEP, the Transitional Justice Tribunal in Colombia, on macro criminal case 002 in the Department of Nariño. That is the first transitional justice case in the country and really probably in the world that's trying to treat the territory as a victim of the conflict and thinking about socio-ecological harm. And not just human rights and international humanitarian law and the kinds of victimization that are recognized in those legal structures, international criminal legal structures. So that's a project that's really combining ethnographic and environmental humanities methods and analytics with pluralistic legal frameworks and inter-ethnic jurisprudences. So I'm working on a project with this legal team in the HEP to do that work of rebuilding, of investigating the kind of impacts on the territory that the conflict produced. And those are the kind of new projects that I've been working on in the past couple of years and that hopefully in the next few years.
Well, all of this sounds fascinating. Thank you again, Cristina, for joining me today. To all of our listeners, thank you for listening to today's episode in which we talked to Cristina Lyons about her new book, Vital Decomposition, published by Duke University Press in 2020. This is your host, Alejandro Ponce de León. Stay tuned for our next episode in New Books in Environmental Studies.